Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, a series all about radio broadcast on the first Monday of every month on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital broadcasting, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on the April edition of Wireless. RTE's long-wave radio service gets another reprieve, this time until 2019, and the Irish in Britain are to get their own replacement digital radio service after that. We ask radio activist Brian Green what it all means. And we meet Mary Ruddy, founder, member and first station manager of one of Ireland's oldest community stations, Connemara Community Radio in Letterfrack.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
But first to Radio Retro, which each month delves into the archives to unearth a gem from radio history. Over the last few months, we've featured some of the pirate radio stations of the 1980s, and we're staying in that decade again this month. Pirate radio during that time was hugely diverse, ranging from tiny, part-time hobby operators broadcasting from garages and garden sheds to large, slick commercial operations that posed a real threat to RTE Radio 2, as it was then known. One of those so-called super pirates was the Dublin station Q102, which went on the air in January 1985, at the height of the bitter dispute between the National Union of Journalists and another pirate broadcasting giant, Radio Nova. Nova, which was owned by Englishman Chris Carey, was heavily losing advertising due to the dispute, and Q102 took advantage of the troubles facing its rival, even emphasising the fact that it was Irish-owned, in contrast to Nova. Q102 took the airwaves by storm with its live traffic reports from a helicopter flying over Dublin during morning rush hour, something that RTE could only dream of at the time. The following recording is from Q102's medium wave transmitter on the 29th of April 1987 during the morning programme. I've chosen this extract because it's a good illustration of the level of sheer professionalism and slickness of Irish pirate radio during its golden age. The recording begins with a promotion for the generous cash prizes being given away by Q102 to its listeners, an indication of the wealth of the station at the time. It's worth remembering that £5,000 was an absolute fortune in the cash-strapped 1980s. Then we hear an ad for the Evening Herald, a major broadcaster for a pirate station, and finally a news bulletin read by the late Bob Gallico, one of the iconic voices of Irish radio in the 1980s.
Q102 has given away thousands and thousands in cash prizes, and it's all so simple.
That's thousands and thousands of pounds just for being caller number 10.
Hello?
You won yourself 1,500 quid.
I don't believe you. Are you serious?
That's thousands and thousands of pounds in cash just for being caller number 10.
You're number 10.
I hate that.
You have just won £6,200 in cash.
Cash and prizes.
A £5,000 luxury dream kitchen.
A Fiat Uno car.
A £3,000 Sony Hi-Fi system.
TV.
Ghetto Blaster,
Walkman,
Computer,
Designer Clothes,
Helicopter Trips,
and more.
Holidays to London,
Paris,
Spain,
Greece,
Barbados.
Any idea what call you are?
Oh, I don't know. I must be spot 9.
No, you're calling number 10.
10, am I?
Albums, compact discs, concert tickets for UB40, Simple Minds, Duran Duran, Wham and Tina Turner at Wembley Stadium, Queen, George Benson,
Spandau Ballet,
Elton John,
Rod Stewart,
and Christopher.
The prize goes to caller number 10.
I'm not.
You are.
I am.
Yes.
All from Q102, the prize capital of the city.
AM 102 and 103.5 stereo FM. This is Q102.
Q102 News, good morning. Northern Secretary Tom King yesterday visited the scene of the bombing which killed Lord Justice Gibson and his wife Cecily on Saturday. Their funerals are being held in Belfast today. Burial is taking place after a service at Fisherwick Presbyterian Church at 11:30 this morning. The family of the late Lord Justice and his wife is understood to have indicated to politicians that they would prefer them not to attend the funeral, and the family is also understood to have expressed the view that members of the Republic's judiciary should not be encouraged to attend. There was a rocket attack on an RUC station in North Belfast last night. Two devices were fired from a launcher in a van which was driven past the fortified station on the Antrim Road. The RUC say no one was injured and damage was confined to the armored gates. A number of shots were also fired from the van. It was later found in the Hillman Estate in the New Lodge area. A number of families had to leave their homes while explosive experts checked the van for booby traps. The families were allowed home shortly after 2:30. The weather prospects, some good sunny spells, but also cloudy at times with occasional showers, some of which may be heavy and thundery. Remaining mild with a high of 16 to 17 degrees Celsius. Winds are south to southwesterly and moderate force 3 to 4. Drying conditions today, moderate at best, and the current city high is 11 degrees. That's Q102 News with Bob Gallico at 9 o'clock.
Time you saw Sony Black Trinitron. Color as not seen on your TV.
Scott Williams.
The late Bob Gallico reading a morning news bulletin on pirate station Q102 in 1987. That recording is courtesy of dxarchive.com. It's worth pointing out that Dublin still has a station called Q102 and that its manager, Scott Williams, was a broadcaster on the original Pirate of the 1980s. If you'd like to send us an archive recording for Radio Retro, feel free to get in touch through social media or on our blog, wirelessflirt.wordpress.com.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
In February, we covered the threat to RTE Radio 1's long-wave service on 252 kHz, which was threatened with closure in June of this year. The lobby group Save RTE Longwave 252 has been campaigning for years to maintain the service, arguing that it's a vital lifeline to Irish emigrants in Britain. When RTE's longwave transmitter in County Meath was operating at full power, it could be heard throughout the UK, although reduced power in recent times has led to a weaker signal and more interference, especially at night. An academic survey of over 3,000 Irish in Britain published last year revealed that most of them preferred the analogue longwave service to listening online. Last month, a consultative group involving RTE, the organisation Irish in Britain, and representatives of the Irish community issued a joint statement saying that RTE had again postponed the closure of Longwave until 2019 and that it planned to introduce a replacement digital radio service aimed at the Irish in Britain. So is this really a victory for the campaigners who want to save RTE on Longwave, or is there more than meets the eye? I spoke to Brian Green in Dublin, a student of journalism and social media and an advocate of all things radio, and I asked him to explain what exactly had been announced about the Longwave service.
Yes, RTE have announced that they are going to cease Longwave in June of 2019 and have a service to the United Kingdom through DAB+. So what has been happening over the years is they've been trying to close down medium wave ever since 2014, and they didn't succeed at that stage. And then in 2017, they tried again, and this time it's been pushed back to 2019.
And the replacement that they have mentioned, or that's been mentioned as part of the agreement, is an RTE service on DAB Plus in the UK. Is this going to be a viable replacement for the longwave service, in your view?
We don't know everything about it, but from what we can gather, and if you look at the lie of the land with, you know, DAB and the United Kingdom and receivers, it could reach a lot of the Irish community. That is something to be said. So if you are in one of the major urban centres, you might get coverage of DAB Plus from RTE in the future. So let's say RTE were to decide to go to 7 or 9 of the major cities, all with populations above 1.5 million. From 9 sites, they could reach 21 million people with a service. And because the Irish have congregated in these urban centres from Belfast and Glasgow and London and Leeds and Manchester and Birmingham and Liverpool, if you go to them, you're going to reach quite a lot of Irish people. So in that sense, it makes some sense. But on another, that's a lot of sites. It's satellite distribution to them all, and you know there's expense in that. And the reason this has been mooted in the first place is the expense of broadcasting on longwave is too much for a cash-strapped RTE. And the cost has been mentioned by the head of radio, Jim Jennings, as a Roxas questioning, and he said, well, if the Department of Foreign Affairs can come up with €250,000 per annum, he would cancel the cancellation of Longwave 252. He'd keep it, but no such money has come about. But, you know, while $250,000 is mentioned, things have changed with RTE's Longwave over the years. Like they took it back and put RTE on Longwave in 2004, having had the frequency allocation for decades, used it for Atlantic 252 from 1990 for best part of a decade, and in 2004 took it back and started using it for themselves for the first time. Within 3 years of that, they were cancelling medium wave and saying Longwave is the future. Mm-hmm. And that was... what year was that they cancelled? 2007. Mm-hmm. 2008. In March 2008, they cancelled the medium wave. So within 3.5 years of having the long wave, medium wave was going, and they were telling us long wave is the way to go forward. And, you know, where are we now? Within 8 years of that, within 6 years of that, they're trying to cancel Longwave.
But they've claimed that the DAB Plus replacement would only cost €50,000 per year. Would you dispute that figure, given the technology that would be needed and the number of cities perhaps needed with multiplexes?
I think it's hard to tell. So if we guess how many cities they're going to and how much it might cost at each city, I think that, let's say it was 10, just for argument's sake and to make the maths a little bit easier, you're thinking, are they getting onto a DAB multiplex of MUX for $5,000 per site, mm-hmm. For a year and satellite distribution to it? I don't think you can do it that cheap. You know, I don't have quotes in my pocket to, but I just think that it does cost, from being on DAB here in Dublin in the past and having prices quoted to me in this jurisdiction, I don't think that you could get a whole year at those sort of prices.
And would you imagine then that the overall cost could perhaps not even be that far away from the $250,000 that the long-wave transmitter is supposed to cost them?
Well, if I go back to a point I didn't get onto about the long-wave, is it costing as much as they're saying? Because when they took on the long-wave again in 2004, it was the old valve transmitter that Atlantic 252 would have used. And within 3 years, they upgraded that to a solid-state transmitter, which had much more efficiencies, and efficiencies would mean that there's a lot less wasted heat and there's a lot more less energy used. So that's a lot of, it's all electricity really when it comes down to the costs of long wave, and a lot less electricity used, and they're operating on half the power that they should be operating on. So given all that, is it really 250,000? And, you know, is the 50,000 realistic as well? So I'd say that the numbers come very close, much more close to each other.
So would you be of the view then that keeping Longwave going on full power is a better option than this DAB Plus service that's been announced? Or do you think the DAB Plus is a positive development if it is rolled out in enough cities to reach the 21 million that you mentioned before as a possible figure?
In fairness to RTE, well, they'd like to shut things down without an alternative plan. But if they are taken to a kind of a staged approach, a leapfrogging, that, you know, they could have used medium wave to get people onto long wave. They could use long wave to get people onto digital. So they need to move the audience to where they want to have them tuning in. Having overnight announcements that we're shutting down this service without any consultation doesn't suit anybody. Mm-hmm. But a phased approach saying this is where we're going and this is when we're doing it is much better. So is that answering your question, which is best? I think the DAB, should it work, and they have to overcome hurdles with Ofcom for licensing, which... I think they should be able to overcome, but you know, there's no guarantee. They're guaranteeing a close down in June 2019, but can they overcome problems with licensing? There's no guarantee. and then they put a new service. That service would, in the match that we're doing here, have to have a zero cost to provide a new channel to the diaspora, which has been talked about, from Ireland. So that would, you know, can you do that with no cost? I don't think you can make dedicated programming at no cost.
And do we know anything about what the new diaspora service would entail, what exactly it would be broadcasting?
This we know even less about than the technical stuff we've just been talking about, but it is to be modelled on RTE Radio 1 style and format.
And what do you think that means?
I think you'll get a good RTE news service on the hour, and probably more like Radio 1 Extra, so that it will be automated and would have a lot of repeats, which does sound awful, but it could also have a lot of live stuff happening as well.
So do you think that there's no future for Longwave then, given this potential move to DAB Plus? Let's say, for argument's sake, that RTE get over the difficulties with Ofcom and that the thing can go ahead and be launched and rolled out in a number of cities. Is that the end of Longwave then for this kind of broadcasting, or is there still an argument for it? Does it have a future?
Well, to answer that, I'd say that go back to mid-2003 when they were bringing Longwave back. They did have a consultation process and they asked people, what would you like us to do with this transmitter? And I remember my own submission, and I don't remember getting to read anybody else's because I think the submissions weren't published in the end. Mm-hmm. And what I had said was they should go for a horse racing channel on Longwave, and to have a service that will be available at every racetrack and to that fraternity, you know, that there will be sport and horse
like
racing.
Like talk sport?
But you know the way Irish horse racing dominates the racing of the British Isles, mm-hmm. in the way that we won so many at Cheltenham and we win at Aintree, and we you know, we're really, really strong in the bloodstock game. I think that could have been a good anchor to what the station is. I think there was also the possibility for political programming in Oireachtas coverage and stuff on Longwave, and services to the diaspora, and you know, a different kind of music service on Longwave at night. Not Atlantic 252, but probably something more in tune with the audience that they do attract to Longwave 252. So if you think of, you know, some horse racing and then mix it with some country and western, country and Irish music, and being that a la Keep It Country on television or Irish TV kind mm-hmm. of content, that there could be some audience for that. It sounds like a very unusual mix of content. But analogue Longwave probably long-term is on the way out. Other European countries are phasing out their transmissions. But it doesn't mean that they can't look to digital formats of Longwave in Digital Radio Mondiale, something that RTE, when they got that new transmitter, decided to test. And they did some wonderful tests around 2007, August of 2007, ahead of the medium wave shutdown. And they did DRM at night, I think it was after 10 p.m. or midnight, on Longwave 252. And the results were amazing.
We've discussed the difficulties of formats before on this programme with John Anderson from New York, who's a specialist on these matters and a radio academic and activist as well. And the point that he was making was that one of the biggest issues is that there are competing formats with DAB, DAB Plus, HD in the States, and DRM as well. So it seems there's a lot of confusion about what format or what formats will actually win out in the end, and that this is very much a transition phase in terms of future formats for radio. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and none of them might win out in the end. It could be a VHS versus Betamax situation. It might not. And, you know, a lot of things are orientating to internet protocol and internet streaming. So, you know, there are, you know, internet is reaching into cars, and cars can dictate where the radio market goes. Like breakfast radio and what's listened to in the car in the morning can dictate what format wins out. It might be no format, it might be just a mishmash of ways to listen to good content.
So in a recent interview with Sean O'Rourke, the new RTE Director General, Dee Forbes, mentioned how RTE was cash-strapped, and in fact selling the land or selling part of the land at Montrose has been mentioned, has been presented as a way of dealing with this issue. So what would you say to those arguments that, you know, having a long-wave service, a dying technology, is really a luxury that RTE can't afford at this time?
I think, yes, reality has struck. There's been a shift away from radio and television with the advertising. It has moved online. And if you take that with the timing of the banking crisis and the international dimensions to that and the downsizing of operations, RTE has had to scale back. And in doing so, it hasn't been spending money in technology areas. And now they really need to invest some money into technology. So they are reorganizing the structures of it. So I think traditionally you would have had radio, isn't television, isn't the RTE guide, isn't digital. And now they're going to have a focus of looking at things as in content streams, so that everything's content, and get rid of the transmitter mentality and speak to content. And that approach I do welcome. They are behind in revenues on license fee. I think they're claiming that there's an evasion rate that's best in the world at around 19%. They're down about 110 million of 440 million in license revenues, and there isn't much hope on the horizon that they will get a license fee increase. Now, maybe that will be a modest one that will come along, something within, in keeping with inflation, but I think they are restructuring. They're selling 9 acres of land at Montrose, which, you know, is land that goes back to when Marconi's family were in the Donnybrook area. And yeah, they're going to sell that off for some development and bring in an estimated 75 million that might exceed that, and then spend that money on technology. There is going to be a downsizing of the organisation as well, and they're talking about in the region of 200, 250 posts being gotten rid of through some voluntary redundancies over the next 2 years.
But Dee Forbes did say in the interview that these changes, these cuts, were necessary in order to maintain services. And of course, the argument can be made that Longwave 252 is a service just like any other service.
Yeah, and to give the exact quote was, these job cuts will help keep services on air. So, you know, if you're looking at what that means, that definitely could be looked to saying, you know, can we keep these services on air? Even to kind of show that there's a plan, you know, can we phase ourselves over time off Longwave and get our listeners onto another platform? You know, that is clever stuff. At the moment, they're kind of saying we're definitely leaving Longwave in June 2019, and we're going to try and do our best to get a DAB Plus service, with no detail on that at the moment. So I'd love to see the detail in this, and I'd love to see involvement with the Irish community across the United Kingdom, that, you know, that they can have some input into what the shape and form of the programming that they do get.
But when we spoke to Richard Logan, this programme, one of the arguments made by the campaign Save RTE Longwave 252 is that 252, of course, is shared by the high-powered station from Algeria, and that blocks out RTE in the UK at night, and indeed even here in Galway, I have to say, at night. And they've been calling for a move to 261, which is a free frequency at the moment. But there's no mention of this at all, as far as I can see, in the announcement by the consultative group.
No, I haven't heard that mentioned, and I don't think anybody has kind of a close affinity with, you know, staying with the kilohertz 252. And a move slightly on the dial, people could be told over, you know, a series of weeks and months to say we are moving frequency, and people just make a very small dial adjustment on an analog dial, and they would, we'd be able to retune in. And, you know, it might make the difference from getting beyond Coventry and getting, you know, a decent signal to the south of London and that kind of region. So, you know, maybe it should be looked at, but, you know, this is something for the operations people in RTE to consider.
There's some other AM news from Dublin, Brian, which is, of course, quite unusual in an Irish context, because we don't have much activity on AM anymore, and this is specifically related to medium wave. So can you tell us what's happening?
Yeah, for the last 8 or 9 weeks, there's been sporadic transmissions on 1395 kilohertz, and most people would have speculated that the previous occupiers of tests and transmissions on that frequency would have been coming back. And that's what it looks like is happening. So over the last 8 or 9 weeks, what has been done is there was relays of digital services out of Ireland, be it Dublin South Community Radio's online stream or Charity Radio in Walkinstown, or laterally Garden Community Radio out of Greystones, GCR Greystones. And these services were being continuously relayed on medium wave, which is kind of interesting because if you're driving around and the AM band is so sparse and unpopulated and you come across this whacking strong signal and you're hearing Irish radio on it. Well, as of last weekend at around 9 a.m, Energy AM were doing live tests under their own name from their own studios, and they're saying that they're keeping AM alive. That's their tagline. And they are coming back now. At the moment, it's a test weekend service, and I'd say for a good while it will remain so, but they're building power, and it's sounding great. It's sounding wonderful.
So a bit like Back to the Future with a new station on AM in Dublin.
Absolutely. I was driving out from Baldoyle to Swords, and I was listening, and there was some classical music from a programme on Dublin South Community Radio about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and it was classical, and there's a lot of high-frequency clarity in that kind of genre of music. Are sounding wonderful on medium wave. Like, you think we've surpassed this technology, but it was so accessible. Then they go around corners and in between buildings, and it's still there.
It's such a unique sound, absolutely, and we're hearing less and less of it these days. So we wish Energy AM the best of luck. We presume this is the same pirate station as before, Brian, is that right?
You would imagine it. I think its location is South County Dublin, and I've no more precise, I haven't tried to track down its origins. But AM has always suffered with the need to have a very long antenna, and where do you site it? So if you were in the outer suburbs, you know, you could achieve this in a very built-up Dublin. I don't know how they did it on Cable Street in the 80s and in the late 70s, but you need a long antenna for medium wave. So I say, you know, fair play to these guys for giving it a go. And what's behind us, this kind of message of keeping medium wave alive, is very interesting. I think if you want to get another example of it doing well, is there's a community radio station with 100 watts of power in Warrington in the United Kingdom, and they are showing how community radio can do little infill transmissions where the FM band is full and DAB isn't practical to get onto because it's a multiplex system, that AM is a way that small communities, like the radios have AM, the cars have AM, so if you want to be connected with your community, AM might be a place that the broadcasting authority could look to license some small stations. Maybe Crail should have a word with the BAI.
Radio activist Brian Green in Dublin telling me about the announcement that RTE is to maintain its long-wave radio service until 2019 and then replace it with a DAB Plus service for the Irish in Britain. When we spoke to Richard Logue of the Save RTE Longwave 252 group in February, we invited RTE to make a representative available for interview, but we received no reply from them. We again invited RTE to come on this month's programme to answer some of the concerns that have been raised, but there was no response this time either. You can read about the Longwave campaign at saverteelongwaveradio.com.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at WirelessFlirt.
Over the past few months, we've featured other radio stations on the programme, and this month is the turn of Connemara Community Radio, which, apart from ourselves at Flirt FM, is the other community station in Galway.
You're listening to Connemara Community Radio, broadcasting on 87.8 and 106.1 FM.
Connemara Community Radio is one of Ireland's oldest community stations and has been broadcasting with a licence to Northwest Connemara since 1995. It broadcasts from studios in Letterfrack for 10 hours each day and relies on about 90 volunteers and a small core staff. The station requires 3 FM transmitters to cover the mountainous terrain of Northwest Connemara and is the only one in the country to operate a studio on an island. Connemara Community Radio is one of the smallest stations broadcasting in Ireland and covers a franchise area of only about 12,000 people, but it has impressive studio facilities and recently received funding to digitise its extensive archives. Recently, I went to Letterfrack to meet Mary Ruddy, a founder member of Connemara Community Radio and its first station manager after the station came on air in 1995. I began by asking her to explain the background to Connemara Community Radio.
I suppose if anybody recalls that period, there were a lot of pirate radio stations on air around Ireland. And I had previously been involved with the European Anti-Poverty Project, and we used to do regular newsletters. And after a couple of years doing the newsletters, there was a sense of, you know, you put the word out, but you never had feedback, and it didn't really allow for much discussion or debate. And we thought radio would really address that. I have to say now, we really had no idea what we were taking on, except there were a lot of pirate stations around at the time. So I was given the job to sort of research on what would be involved. The fact that it was unlicensed and illegal at the time really didn't matter much, because there was kind of a blind eye being turned to pirate stations. And one of the first people we actually contacted was Bray Local Radio, a woman there called Sally Reynolds. And I remember she inviting me to come up and have a look at what they were doing. And I have to say, I was really kind of gobsmacked, because when I'd been doing the research, I suppose what I was looking at was the technical aspects of radio, what would be involved. And I knew from our own background here and what we were working at, there'd be a strong history of community development in this area and in Ballinakil and in Letterfrack in particular. So we always had a sense of the kind of radio we wanted would be very kind of, you know, very participative, that, you know, access would be very wide. There'd be strong, you know, underlying values of kind of participation and democratisation. But I hadn't actually known there was a form of radio, a structure in radio called community broadcasting. I thought there was radio, and I just thought that was really so interesting, because they then were aligned to a wider global movement called AMARC, which is the French acronym for Association Mondiale Radio Communautaire, so the World Association of Community Radio, and that started in Montreal. So then I was getting access to all of this material about radio stations in South America and Canada, Australia, and, you know, very similar, or very, in terms of philosophy, very much what we wanted to do ourselves. But and different kinds of structures were in place there. So I then got involved with AMARC and became a member. So then we got our own radio station on air, and then there was a conference in Nicaragua that I attended. And again, that was absolutely kind of mind-blowing in terms of the kinds of radio, and some, you know, totally anarchic and no structures whatsoever, and others, you know, quite structured, and some very left-wing, some more, I suppose, like ourselves, would have more of a community base. Now, there used to be kind of a joke in AMARC that the Irish community radios were the kind of scouts of the community radio movement, because they, in general, while they might have kind of a left leaning, they tended to be more community based than necessarily political, which wouldn't be true for a lot of the community radio stations around the world. Some of them would have very clear agendas. But it was just, I just have found it so interesting to see the kinds of radio. And I remember at one stage when we came back, and I was anxious that other people would experience, you know, would see this kind of radio. And a group of us who'd been involved with the pirate station went to visit a community radio in the south of France, near Marseille. It was called Langomaille. It was a co-op, a big co-op in that region, which is now the stronghold of the Le Pen regime. And he was just beginning to get a foothold in it at the time. And now they were quite a radical group who used to take a lot of people, like North Africans, and would work with them. And they had projects there. They were also quite wealthy. I never quite understood the full Langomaille thing, but it was a big outfit. But they had a radio station, and absolutely no format. You know, there wouldn't be a program schedule, but they did very interesting things. Like, for example, they wouldn't have a news service. But they, because it was a big kind of international co-op, they would have people from different parts of the world there. So the English member might look at the Guardian newspaper, somebody else would look at Le Monde and the German papers and the US papers and see how different papers were covering big international stories. Really interesting. We came back then and I remember we got, because we were training up for our legal station at this time, and I remember we got Lilia Doolan out to do a training session with us. And one of the first exercises Lilia gave us to do was to do a 2-minute radio news piece. And, you know, if it was over by 10 seconds, you know, it was like, not okay, go back and do it. And it was just so interesting to see this, you know. So one end of it, like the Langemai and the radio, the thing went on for as long as people wanted to talk. And then we were getting, I suppose, some like Lilia who came, now, obviously with her own very, you know, individual aspect, but she had come through, I suppose, like an RTE, and she was trying to, you know, teach us the skills of kind of, you know, good editing and so forth. But it was a very interesting time.
And what kind of interest did you take in the values behind community radio? I mean, you mentioned already the democratisation and the participation and so on, and obviously those are the backbone of the AMARC Charter. Why was that so important, do you think, in an area like this, that you'd have those kind of values underpinning a local broadcaster?
To be honest, I think they just knitted in very well with the kind of... I suppose I would have come from a community development background, and those values were... I suppose they would underpin that approach to work as well. So there was never any consideration of it being a privately owned station or a commercial radio station. I mean, that just never came into the equation at all. And there would be, you know, a strong enough grouping of people locally who would totally share those values. So it actually was, it wasn't in any way a challenge to what we had previously thought. It very much kind of knitted in with our own thinking.
And there were 5 years, there was a hiatus of at least 5 years before community radio was legalised. The first independent radio and television commissions were not prioritising that sector. But then that changed in the mid-1990s, and you indeed were very closely involved in that because you were appointed to the IRTC, as it was then, by Michael D. Higgins when he was Minister for Communications. So can you tell us a little bit about that and how that came to pass?
Yeah, I do recall, as I suppose all the pirate stations recall, the New Year's Eve of 89 when we all had to go off air. And at the time, so the legislation that was brought in at the time was very severe. So if you did broadcast prior to that, it was kind of laissez-faire. But after that, there were very strict penalties, including, for example, if anybody advertised on the station, they were liable for fines and severe fines as well as the broadcaster. So all of the pirates literally went off air. And interestingly, though, to get a legal license subsequently, it was actually kind of a badge of honour that you had broadcast, so you had the experience. It was just a quirky thing, but yeah. So we went off air, and then I have to say, I still look back on those 5 years as kind of a wasted 5 years, and I just think of Minister Burke, you know, the dishonesty of it in the way that licensing happened. The demand, there was RTE at the time, RTE had the monopoly. And I don't think there was a major dissatisfaction with RTE as a national station, but there was very much a demand for regional and local broadcasting. And that's really where all the pirate experience came. And yet when the IRTC were formed, the first station they broadcast was a national station. Was it Radio Ireland?
Century Radio.
Yeah. That never made sense to me. That, you know, where the demand was for the local and the regional broadcasting. And then they subsequently licensed the county stations. And then they were just, by this time, Century was falling apart. And so the IRTC already had one kind of failure on their hands. Then the county stations had set up and found that maybe it wasn't quite as lucrative a business because they were all commercial. And there was a lot of opposition to further divvying up the listening audience, who were what the advertisers want to know about. And so the IRTC, for those kinds of reasons, decided against any further licensing of smaller radio stations, including the likes of ourselves. And we were very involved at the time with the NACB, the National Association of Community Broadcasting, with people like Sally Reynolds and Jack Byrne in Dublin, trying to put pressure on to get the community broadcasting in place. But there was really very little shift and an awful lot of opposition from the existing radio stations. And that continued right until there was a change of government and Michael D was then appointed, fortunately for us. And he had a great interest in community radio. And he put a new board in place in the IRTC that was chaired by Niall Stokes of Hot Press at the time. And I was one of the people appointed. And there were a number of people on that board who had a particular interest in community broadcasting. So it was actually one of the first things was to open up the possibility of licensing community radio stations. But in the period prior to that, I'd been involved with AMARC, and I actually worked with them in their European office, which was based in England at the time. And in that time, we were developing this AMARC charter for community broadcasting, just the principles of good community radio. And I suppose I was fortunate in that because I was on the board of the IRTC, I was able to bring that to the notice of the IRTC and have that enshrined as part of the contract. So it was, I think, as far as I'm aware, at the time anyway, it was the only national authority that incorporated the AMARC charter into the contract. But I think it has stood the test of time, and it does, you know, it is a kind of a baseline against which, you know, to judge I suppose how well or how not successful, but how well a radio station is operating as a community radio.
So do you think, was this hiatus political, or was it linked to the opposition from commercial radio, or was it a mixture of both?
I think it was a mixture of both. Certainly the minister at the time had zero interest in community broadcasting, but it was also pressure from the operating stations. They were having difficulty surviving. They were trying to get advertising in, which is why, I mean, even though we didn't have great opposition ourselves in the community radio sector to limiting advertising, initially the IRTC wanted the community stations to have no advertising, but there was no subsidy or no other replacement for the... So we did make an argument at the time for some limited, and we didn't mind the fact that it could be limited because you wouldn't want to be, you know, beholden to any particular advertiser. But it was that kind of pressure. There was commercial pressure at the time as well.
And there was no impediment, of course, in the 1988 legislation to community broadcasting. It was simply an administrative decision taken by the Broadcasting Commission, wasn't it?
It was. The chair at the time was a former judge, Hinchy. And when that board got established, there was absolutely no reason. I mean, they could have prioritised community broadcasting or local radio or even the county stations, but they didn't. That was the format they took, which was very conservative, and they were very there was very little empathy or sympathy for community broadcasting on that board.
But that changed, obviously, with the new commissioning. You were involved in that yourself. So how did that link then to the establishment of the legalised Connemara Community Radio just across from us here?
Well, very quickly, because to be honest, ever since the pirate days in 89, when we went off air at that time in 1990, we were getting ready to put forward our application for a licence. And that's why I still look back on those 5 years as kind of, for Connemara Community Radio, as sort of wasted years. There was a lot of energy. There was already a group together. In fact, there was even a FOSS scheme in place, and we had them out doing recordings, which resulted in a very nice book eventually that was edited by Aaron Gibbons. So that particular programme was to interview older people in the community around particular things, not just a general one. So, for example, we took with older women the traditions of childbirth, and, you know, there was a lot of kind of early mortality stories, and that whole thing then gave expression to, you know, the unbaptised children being buried outside of graveyards. And in fact, I always think that's a kind of an interesting thing about the power of radio in a very local way. That particular project, we recorded a number of women who had stillbirths, and just over the years, obviously, carried the grief of having their children not buried in graveyards. And they would be in sand dunes, and they would see these sand dunes being eroded. And so after it got published in the book, and Noel Brown at the time had written the foreword, it kind of, I don't know, kind of released that, and some of those remains were reinterred in a public ceremony in a local graveyard. But I thought it was an interesting thing how once something gets expressed in the public arena, it kind of enables people to address it. But anyway, that was sort of a by the by. But so all these things were happening in that period, in those five year periods, to keep the project alive. But it was frustrating, you know. You were doing these recordings and they weren't getting broadcast, or they weren't going anywhere. And eventually, then once the decision, the new IRTC board came into place, it happened quite quickly, the licensing. So a number of community stations got broadcast, got licences fairly quickly, and then we were on air and still are. Yeah.
And you were the first manager, so you were leading the project for the first 5 years, from 1995 until 2000. Can you tell us a little bit about the excitement of getting a new station on air? There must have been an incredible sense of expectation after such a long gap between the pirate experiment and the actual legalised station.
There was, I suppose... And like resources were very limited, and as you can imagine, the terrain here, we had only one transmitter at the time. Now there's a second one who had to come into play fairly quickly afterwards, because the region we had such kind of limited area, but. So there was all of that, which was quite challenging, and then the efforts to just fundraise to. You know, equip a studio. We had staff mainly through FOSS schemes. None of us would have come from professional broadcasting backgrounds. So we're kind of all very much learning on the job. Now, one of the things we did do, which to help finance us, but it was, I mean, it had its own problems, was we submitted a project under an EU Now project, New Opportunities for Women, which was fairly well funded. And on the basis of that, we were able to train a number of women, mainly in kind of what they would see as non-traditional areas, so like in sports coverage, in technical areas. But what it did enable us to do was to equip a couple of studios to get the funding to do that. And so at one level, you were kind of running an EU project, and then you were trying to have whatever finances that was generating to run the radio station. So, you know, your energies were kind of a bit spread. But it did give us kind of the necessary finances to get, and also the skills, and it did, you know, provide training for quite a number of women who then became involved as volunteers with the station, or in some cases as workers. So there's a number of kind of projects like that we would have been doing just to try and keep the show on the road. But overall, I have to say, my own view was when we were starting was that, you know, the money is always going to be an issue, and it is a headache. But, you know, money isn't the thing that will ever kind of cause the project to fail, I think. In my view, it wasn't the thing. My view was the thing that will cause this to fail is that we'll stop getting volunteers to do programming and to do reports and to do technical work. And when that happens, the thing has failed. But happily, that has never happened. There's always been in the region of 90 people involved on a weekly basis in the radio. And that figure has never really varied hugely. It's gone up a little bit, maybe down a little bit, but it's stayed fairly steadfast. And, you know, the funding continues to be a challenge and probably always will be. But it isn't the thing that will, I think, cause the radio to fail ultimately.
Would you say that core funding of some sort is needed? Because there doesn't even seem to be core funding for community radio in Ireland.
It would really make a difference. You know, it just means you're not doing the thing, like taking your energy away from running a radio station to do other projects in order to find funds to run the radio station. That would have made such a difference. And there's really no reason that can't be. There's, you know, that the fund that the BAI have, you know, the licence fees, that's a significant source of funding from within the sector itself. So, there's really no reason. And if in light of the fact that the community stations are limited and how much advertising they can take, you know, there should be a quid pro quo there, that there would be some support. So it would be certainly, I think it would be hard to see why there wouldn't be some level of core funding. It would make a huge difference.
Another interesting aspect of your station is the fact that it's the only station in the country to have a studio on an island, on Inish Boffin. So did that begin during your period as manager?
It did. I suppose it was very much in keeping with the ethos of the station, that, you know, it needs to be accessible for people to come in and to volunteer. And really, you know, practically it wasn't accessible for, if you were living on Inishmaffin Island, to come into the studio. And we made an application under the Ireland Fund to locate a studio on the island from which there could be regular programming. And that was successful, and we set the studio up. I can't remember. I think it was maybe 88 or so. I do remember the day we went in, though. It was really wild.
88, even before the legislation.
Sorry, no, 98, sorry, 98. And the poor supplier who brought the studio in his van to Cleggan thought he was getting onto a drive-on, drive-off ferry. And it was quite a wild day. So I do recall that he was a very nervous technician and worried about the return journey. And it was a wild day, I have to say. But anyway, we did get the studio up and running, and they're still doing their programming from Inishmaffin Island. So, yeah, we have that unique distinction of our offshore studio.
And what other highlights do you remember from your 5 years as manager of Connemara Community Radio?
The small little things, really. I do recall the time we went off air in 89, a letter coming into the studio saying about, so sorry we're going off air, but really looking forward to the station coming back, and saying that it was the first time in living here that they felt they were living in the centre of things rather than on the periphery. That, you know, the even small things like listening to the weather forecast, you know, rain coming in from the west, as opposed to where. And I just thought that was really interesting, that actually where you live is actually the centre of the universe. You know, it is the centre of your universe. And if you live, I suppose, in a region like this where, you know, in describing it, people always use the phrases, you know, on the periphery or distant or far out. But, you know, that's not the case if you're living here, you know. So I just thought that was an interesting observation. And I suppose, you know, over the years, various people would have said about, you know, the importance of the radio for themselves, or very often for elderly people, like who will be housebound, and that will be kind of a lifeline to what's going on. And then over the years, I suppose we've done kind of interesting projects. And one that's still running is the Arts on Air, which is it's a big undertaking that the radio does every year with Clifton Community Arts Festival, which is literally move the studio in, or set up a studio, like a pop-up studio in Clifton. And over the course of the 10 days of the festival, I think we do something like 43 or 44 hours live programming. So it's very intense, but it means that if people either, people listening on the internet or people who are at home and can't get to concerts or readings or whatever, they can still, they still get the benefit of the festival if they're interested. So, and I know for lots of people, kind of the sports commentary is really important. And so I suppose it is that, just that it's, it has a value for a lot of people on an individual level.
What difference do you think the radio has made to this area?
I suppose it just, it does mean, I suppose, that there's a better kind of flow of information about what's happening. I think people are quite proud of it, you know, have a certain pride in it. There's a lot of people involved. You know, I'm sure there are some people in the community who've never been on the radio, but there are an awful lot of people who have, as children, you know, older people, young people, various interests. I think it's a very open, welcoming atmosphere. So I think anybody who approaches the radio, I can't imagine they've ever been, you know, rejected or not taken seriously or respectfully, you know. So on a larger level, it's really, I suppose it's so hard to tell, really, isn't it? How would you measure that?
And the archives then, I was showing your archives this morning, and there's a very impressive selection of tape recordings, videotape recordings, which are in sound format, obviously, going right back to the first day in July 1995. So obviously you made a very conscious decision to keep an archive from day one. Not every other station in Ireland would have an archive so comprehensive as this.
Yeah, we did. Well, there were two things. One is you had to record everything that went out and keep it for, I think it was 90 days legally. But we did, I mean, a lot of people, and I tell you, there were times it was tempting to reuse the tape because we had to buy these, and that was another expense, but we didn't. And I think from very early on, we were aware, partly maybe it's because some of the recordings we made initially were with older people, and even in, you know, over a year period, some of those people had died. And so they brought with them. So we were conscious at an early stage that this really should be kept. And what we were going to do with them, we really didn't know. So it's great now that this project is in place and that, you know, the kind of gems that are in there will be protected, because that's always a danger that, you know, the quality can deteriorate. But
Of course, we're talking about a digitisation project funded by the Broadcasting Authority.
Yeah. We did it, yeah, from the early stages that those tapes were kept, yeah, from day one.
So you must be delighted that you made a decision to keep them so carefully.
I suppose, yeah. Yeah, I'm obviously a hoarder. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about your involvement in Connemara Community Radio before we finish up?
Not really. I suppose it was just, it was kind of exciting to be involved in. It was really interesting to see how the station here fitted in with kind of other community radio stations kind of globally, that while we could be quite different in lots of ways, but the, you know, at some level there was a kind of a community radio family globally who shared a lot of the same values. So I think that was interesting, even though, you know, it's a small station in a small area, it is part of a bigger family of community radio.
Mary Ruddy, founder, member and first station manager of Connemara Community Radio in Letterfrack. You can listen on 87.8 and 106.1 FM in northwest Connemara or online at connemarafm.com. And we send our very best wishes to Mary and to the current station manager, Grainne O'Malley, and we hope to see you again very soon. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. We'll be back on the first Monday in May with more news from the radio world, including an interview with radio academic Andrew O'Beale about the challenges facing student and community radio groups in the US. I do hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. There's also a blog accompanying the programme, wirelessflirt.wordpress.com. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.